All right. Good morning. My name is Marco Casagrande. I come from Finland. Greetings from Finland. Actually, I'm an architect, but somehow slipped away from the normal architectural work quite early in my career. I do houses, but my houses are a little bit weird, maybe more like ruins. I do environmental art and ecological urban planning, focusing on the ecological restoration of existing cities. Here are some key words what I will be talking about: environmental art, urban acupuncture, and insect architecture. The first work is from East Finland. Actually, I grew up in Lapland, the most north part of our country, somehow on the border between the northern forest and the tundra, north of our village. I'm a village person, so to say, but north of us is the Saame, the nomads. And the nomads came to our village to get some milk and alcohol. But so I grew up with these two cultures, and they were very normal for me. Also, the village people like us, we do a lot of hunting and fishing and so on, very close to nature. Then I went to study architecture, and that's in the south. And pretty soon found out that this childhood village, as the rest of the Finnish countryside, started to desert. Like people were moving to the cities of the south and abandoning cultures and traditions, how to live together with nature in very, very rapid time. So I wanted to comment on that together with some friends of ours, and made this work called Landscape. We took three abandoned barn houses and an abandoned field, and lift the barn houses on top of legs so that they can walk after the farmers to the cities of the south, sort of longing after the farmers. The structure itself is very, very simple. It's just a 2x4 frame. Then you have those pine tree trunks upside down as legs, 10 meters high, and then in the end lift the barn house on top as a hat. This work was significant for me because it was the first time that we were our own clients. Nobody asked us to do this. We are the clients and we were the architects, but we also construct this and we put our money in it. We got the permissions and so on, so no big boys in between telling us what to do or what not to do, which is not normal with architecture. When it was done and people started to like it, even some moose came from the forest to look at it, and it was very, very good feeling. But also another weird thing what I did not expect was that I started to get jealous for my own work. It's like it was standing there, but I didn't feel like good. I didn't feel good. It was nice in the beginning, but then when it's just stand there, I feel it's like rotting away. And then I was talking to some contemporary dancer, guy called Reijo Kela, and asking what is happening with me. And he said that it's normal that in performance arts, this is a standard feeling, that you just haven't acted or you haven't finished your act. And this is some sort of a performative architecture, and there is an energy axis, and you need to control this energy axis. And now it's just left floating there. So we needed to finish the project. And this is Reijo Kela. We made an announcement to the local newspaper saying that there will be free sausage and vodka. So 6,000 people came. It's a very cheap trick to fame in Finland, of course. But and then this dancer was making his choreography, 47 minutes dancing there and giving vodka to people, burning fires, make sausage and get drunk and more mad and mad and cooking up things, and then in the end just put the whole thing to fire. I saw there was a fire department here, so this is specially for you. So put the whole thing on fire. And in some way we just wanted to give this very humble piece of architecture or environmental art a way to how to speak out loud. In another way, of course, it's a very kind of violent act to burn houses, and I didn't know how people would react, or we didn't know. They formed a circle around this burning barn houses, and some people start crying, and some people started to shout, like predicting future, and very shamanistic feeling. Village was burning there, and still strong feeling of like some sort of collective subconscious being like activated and started to talk. Very interesting. Fracture itself is very, very simple. It's just a 2x4 frame. Then you have those pine tree trunks upside down as legs, 10 meters high. And then in the end, lift the barn house on top as a hat. This work was significant for me because it was the first time that we were our own clients. Nobody asked us to do this. We are the clients and we were the architects, but we also construct this and we put our money in it. We got the permissions and so on. So no big boys in between telling us what to do or what not to do, which is not normal with architecture. When it was done and people started to like it, even some moose came from the forest to look at it, and it was very, very good feeling. But also another weird thing what I did not expect was that I started to get jealous for my own work. It's like it was standing there, but I didn't feel like good. I didn't feel good. It was nice in the beginning, but then when it's just stand there, I feel it's like rotting away. And then I was talking to some contemporary dancer, guy called Reijo Kela, and asking what is happening with me. And he said that it's normal that in performance arts, this is a standard feeling, that you just haven't or you haven't finished your act. And this is some sort of a performative architecture, and there is an energy axis, and you need to control this energy axis. And now it's just left floating there. So we needed to finish the project. And this is Reijo Kela. We made an announcement to the local newspaper saying that there will be free sausage and vodka. So 6,000 people came. It's a very cheap trick to fame in Finland, of course. But and then this dancer was making his choreography, 47 minutes dancing there and giving vodka to people, burning fires, make sausage and get drunk and more mad and cooking up things and then in the end just put the whole thing to fire. I saw there was a fire department here, so this is specially for you. So put the whole thing on fire. And in some way we just wanted to give this very humble piece of architecture or environmental art a way to how to speak out loud. In another way, of course, it's a very kind of violent act to burn houses, and I didn't know how people would react, or we didn't know. They formed a circle around this burning barn houses, and some people start crying, and some people started to shout, like predicting future, and very shamanistic feeling. Village was burning there, and still strong feeling of like some sort of collective subconscious being like activated and started to talk. Very interesting. We thought that this is for us kind of a business, kind of a harakiri, like a nice way of finishing our practice. But I think the other thing what is not predictable and what was good with this is that we were so engaged with this work that we forgot all kind of posing and normal stuff what architects do. And it was like honest enough, I guess. So this picture started to spread around in Finland and then around the world. First one to react was the Architectural Review in UK, which was very surprising. And we also got this Emerging Architecture Award and so on. But it's a total accident. Then part of this Architectural Review's jury was an architect from Italy, Massimiliano Fuxas, and he was to become the director of Venice Biennale And then he called us and invited there, said that we should do another, like architectonic scale installation, to comment on the theme of the Biennale, which this year was Città, less aesthetics, more ethics, somehow to discuss the urban problematics. What I wanted to do is to have a boat, put a forest into the boat in Finland, and then sail the boat to Venice and open it as a public park. Some of our team were biologists, and they said that my idea is unsound, that trees don't sail. They will die somewhere in the Biscaya Bay or somewhere there when the climate is changing, that you need to find the trees in the same climate belt. So we went to Venice and start looking for trees and start looking for the ship. This was 7 weeks before the opening. And in the end, we found this abandoned barge called Topo Gigio. It was in Chioggia, 50 kilometers south of Venice. And it was abandoned, full of mud and dirt. So we could just take it ashore, clean it up, and start to do welding, make it waterproof again, and then cut some openings to the central axis in order to create a series of interior spaces, and then start to think about the forest. All the material here is just found, lying around or borrowed. This Larsen element, what you use for reinforcing the islands. There you have a Nokia cable for the handrail, and well, Topo Gigio was just taken, and even the trees are borrowed. Then when during this work, I also get this weird feeling that the work is not good enough. This kind of feeling of horror or sickness that you know it must be better. It's not there yet. You could realize this stage too, but it's not the real work. It's not alive. And then for some reason we start to think what are the other layers there would be, and it needed to get more personal. So then we start to think like what happens when you flush a toilet in Venice. Where does everything go? And so we started to track down this material. It all ends up in one place called Biocomp. There's a very fine character called Dottore Codato who runs the show. And we ask him how much annually Venice produces human waste. And he had his book and showed the number. And then we ask him, what is that in 1 hour? It was 67 cubic meters. Then we ask him that, can we have it? And he says, of course. And he liked that somebody appreciates his work. And then he take us to see this like cloaca maxima. It's maybe diameter 5 meter tube where the thing is coming to sedimentation pools and then starts the biological cleaning process and in the end composting it. Very fine system. So this we did with him. We biologically cleaned 67 cubic meters of human waste and composted it and then took it to the boat. It's under the white stones. So in the last room, you go and there is no trees anymore. It's just a marble stone saying that this park has been planted on 60 minutes worth of human waste produced by the city of Venice. With this work, we cooperate with some landscape architecture students. Most of the works that you see here is done together with students. Here is the material, very fresh, or let's say al dente condition. And then we just put the white stones on top of it, and the thing was done. The big reward was to sail with this ship from Chioggia to Venice, and then put it to the Arsenale harbor and open it as a public park. This is another very small work from Norway, close to Bergen, in the end of Hardangerfjord, the settlement called Rosendal. They contacted us and said that they don't have any piazza for the village, some central square that could we come and have a look at that. And we went to the place, and it's so beautiful, like huge Hardangerfjord coming, and this is in the end of it. of course, terraced all the houses on the mountains, and every house is focused to the sea. It's a Viking settlement. And then say that, no square for you, that you are focused already to the sea, and that's your thing. And yeah, that we will build you a floating sauna instead of a square, that this is in a place where every house can see. They can go there with rowing boats or by swimming, set up the sauna and enjoy it a bit. It's working as a lantern nighttime, and it's again very humble, small thing. It's semi-transparent, you can see when the things are cooking, maybe not too detailed, but still. And the floor is water, so there's the benches, but you can just you can sit up, and then it's maybe plus 80 degrees, and then jump straight to the Atlantic. It's all improvised here because we were on the village already doing the square, but we do this, and then just took some material around the village. This is a Jotul stove from Norway, and put the stones in a bucket and just improvised the whole thing. Again with students. Here's another village from Japan in the Niigata province, a small rice farming settlement called Kuramata. Had similar kind of problems like what we have in Finland, or actually everywhere in the world. People move to cities. They have rice farming traditions of like ages. But now in the village is only 120 people. All the young people have disappeared. And they wanted us to comment, make a work to comment on that somehow. And there was an illegal garbage dump. It's in here, just next to the river, and everything else was beautiful, the rice farms. And said that if you can get this garbage dump and a little bit organize that, so that would be the work. And here in the foreground, so there is the small river, rice farms, and the stack of oaks. That's where the garbage dump was. And there we build a park for post-industrial meditation. It's the rice farms, and you have those steps. The last one is made of steel now. That's our park. It's a very simple structure, bolted together there. 130 meters long. Done of Kawasaki steel, 1 inch thick. And it's some sort of mixture of temple and machine, or maybe broken machine, which is already start to grow those trees. We visited a lot of their local shrines and Zen gardens, temples, and small places where people are contemplating with nature. They have a very strong Shinto religion there, which is very close to nature. So in here too, many of those elements that we could see on this somehow holy places are replaced with industrial junk. But these industrial elements, like, they can also actually reach a level where the same kind of this contemplation or meditation feeling starts happening. And even they can focus on these trees or nature. Here is recycled asphalt and recycled glass, broken concrete, and then some gravel. It is a permanent work. It's organized by the Echigo Tsumari Triennale. And then deeper in the park you go, the higher the walls will become. Bolted structure, opening to the Shinto temple. Here is where all the village can sit. And then in the end, the trees sort of disappear, and the steel starts narrowing up, and then turns around a bit and becomes an interior space that is focused to the river. You can go to the river. There is some fish called ayu, and fish your ayu, come up here, grill it, eat it, go home. This is from Anchorage, Alaska. the Alaska Design Forum invited us there, and we went. Didn't know what to do, so we just went to the place and started to cook up something. Anchorage is all about oil, so we wanted to make a temple for oil. There is Alaska Railroad oil tanks. We blowtorch them into 4 pieces each, then erected them to make this a very small, quite brutal-looking temple. Outside is industrial, heavy. And then you come inside, it turns all red. The work itself is called Red Rum. It's from Stanley Kubrick's movie Shining. Murder spelled backwards. The whole floor is made of oyster shells, which is the origin of Alaskan oil. And then you have a fireplace. So the walls are strong enough and high enough, so when you go in there, actually the city disappears. You don't get the feeling that you are maybe in any place. The oysters are making nice sound and they smell. And then you have these red walls and just see the sky, especially if you set up the fire. So the spatial feeling is quite strong. This is from Havana, Cuba. Went there and was quite happy to have a look around and then make a proposal for the Biennale, saying that I want to collect books from all around the world, political, philosophical, ideological books, religious books, talking about big questions, and then import them to Cuba in all languages and use them as bricks for building material. But then we received a letter from the Cuban government saying no, that you are not bringing those books, that you can still do another work, but it must be completely abstract without any kind of ideological meanings whatsoever. This was a good starting point. And so we were back to Finland, and we had already been to this university, so we knew there was lying around this huge iron bar for some reason. So we packed up 10 kilometers of fishing line from Finland and flew back and stretched this iron bar between two university buildings. And the work is called Quetzalcoatlus, which was the last flying dinosaur. Died when the environmental conditions became too hostile for it. But it works so that when the sun is up, the iron gets hot. And when the iron gets hot, the fishing lines are stretching, so it comes down almost to the ground. And then here it is almost in the ground already. So then when the sun goes down and the iron chills, it comes up. So it makes a slow motion flying movement according to the temperatures of the day. It's a very dense system, or tense in this way, that if you cut down one of these lines, the whole system will collapse. It makes a nice sound when you hit it, like boom. It's commenting on Cuba, which is, of course, one of the last flying dinosaurs, and some beauty in the rusty flight of it, though, and makes good sound. But if one of the lines go, the whole system might collapse. This is the work that I wanted to do in Cuba with those books. So I couldn't get rid of the idea. And then we started to collect from all over the world, even North Korea, actually. We start receiving books, 15,000 religious, political, ideological books, and then we fill some vans with the books and drove them to Florence, Firenze, in Piazza della Repubblica, kind of birthplace of a futurist movement, and made this wall. The process with this was such that when we start laying those books around in languages what the people definitely could not read, most of them at least. So people were very ready to confront us. They came very close and asking, what are we going to do with the books? And, are you going to burn them? And they were kind of angry. And we explained that we're not going to burn them, that we'll just make this wall and that's it. But they were not like satisfied. It was not the answer. And they was asking more about what is this about. And this is it. That there is the title backs are here and you can see where is Quran or Bible or Bhagavad Gita or Das Kapital. And that's it. You go around and in the end, if you go inside, everything becomes white paper. You no longer can tell, like, where is Quran or Bible. And that's it. Then when this was done, it took us 1 year to collect the books and maybe 2 weeks doing this in Firenze. And then we finished it and went to relax a bit, a couple of days, and then come back. What we found out was that the whole thing had disappeared. And I didn't know why. I was just like walking around and what the hell happened. And there's this restaurant on the background called Giubbe Rosse. So they came to us and said that, you want to know what happened? I said, of course. And they show us the security camera from the restaurant, where you can see in the corner is our work. It's fantastic, this kind of green color movie. Quite a few people is watching these books. And then comes one guy with a suitcase, he's walking, and what is people watching? He go there and then he tries if he can get the book. Of course he can. He takes a book, put the suitcase and walk away. So immediately after that, boom, the people attack and rip it to parts. Like, you can see this kind of like grandfathers with 5 kilo of Lenin written in Lithuanian, what definitely cannot read. And one must take it home. And well, now it's somehow continuing in their, bookshelves. You have those books in strange languages and what happened. But it was very interesting. And also for the Biennale of contemporary art in Florence. So this attack of people was such dramatic thing that they gave us the first prize called Lorenzo il Magnifico Award. Total accident. And this is then from Tokyo. We got invited and I was very happy. I wanted to deal with this very ultra-urban conditions like Ginza or Shinjuku or Roppongi. And I was cooking up all kind of ideas what to do there. And then we went there, but Yokohama Triennale was showing us the place that here is your site. And it was on the harbor in Yokohama, very far away from these centers. And got a bit disappointed and then had to change the strategy totally. And then we started to think, like, how can we attack the city from outside? And the work is called Bird Cage. It's a very simple structure of rebars, and then you have hemp rope, which is used for tying off the boats in the Yokohama harbor. We make the hemp rope to go around this bird cage and then just wait for the rain. And when the rain came, the rope gets wet. When it dries, it shrinks. And then when it shrank, it gets very, very constructional, together with this little bit of steel. Should use more of this, actually. It's very interesting. It's a silo, so we wanted to imitate how birds are attacking the cities and spreading seeds. You know, when you eat a cherry and fly over the city and plant the cherry seed somehow with the fertilizer in it, and then a tree starts growing and eventually the forest will overtake Tokyo. But this was the first thinkings of, let's say, bio-urban acupuncture, because you can see all around the city this, always when there's a small crack in the industrial layer, and nature starts rooting in it. Basically, it can take over the city from the very small cracks. This kind of city made of cracks is very interesting, and what can grow out of that. The birds are made of these pieces of balsa. The wingspan of the bird is something like 70-80 centimeters. 72 days of Yokohama Triennale, so we made 72 birds. Inside of every bird there is a test tube and five basic seeds of Japanese vegetables, soya, soba, rice and so on, and a small letter that who has found this bird is asked to put vegetation to the ground and grow it up and inform us where the bird is found. Kind of like message in a bottle. But every day one bird would be attached to a meteorological balloon. It's filled with helium. And then the helium will start taking the bird up. It takes it up to 9.7 kilometers. And in 9.7 kilometers, air is so thin, so the helium will actually burst the balloon. When it explodes, the bird gets loose. Then it drops down until it gets enough oxygen, and then when there is enough oxygen, it starts gliding. It's a glider. It can glide for hundreds of kilometers, depending on the winds, landing on some of the Japanese islands, or it can go to the Pacific Ocean. But it's amphibious, so it can go to Manchuria or Taiwan or United States. And then we start receiving these messages. For example, one guy in Ginza was working in his office in a skyscraper, and the bird hit his window. And when it hit his window, he got shocked, but the bird was already flying or dropping down, and he realized that it's like not normal bird. So he started like looking for it, and he found it. And then he was very proudly growing his rice and writing to us and sending photos, how is the vegetation doing. Also, Japan Times was writing a big article about this, that this our birds is kind of an antithesis of the 9/11 terrorist attack, because we are also hitting the skyscrapers with our birds, but instead of the destruction, we are bringing some sort of a connection between modern man and nature. Yeah, this was interesting. This is from Qinmen in Taiwan, very close to China. The skyscrapers or big buildings, what you see is already China. It's maybe 10 kilometers in between. And went there, and it was an interesting place. A very strong oyster farming culture, 400 years. And but same time, they've been having war with China, especially 50s, 60s. Quite heavy shelling. And everywhere was like beautiful beaches, but you have those anti-landing poles everywhere, barbed wire and so on, nobody swimming. But still, like, they're useless. There is no war anymore, and all the steel had been rusting down, so oysters had overtaken them. And they become just the oyster poles. And that was very charming to see that this kind of military infrastructure can also be overtaken by nature, and nature can just read it first and start using it. So it's kind of an oyster city now. And I wanted to make a work for that called Oystermen. This is the Oystermen. It's a tidal shore. So quite big tide, quite big, 3 meters. So here is the tide is down, and there is a road under the sea. You can walk to a very small island, and the oyster man is standing beside it. And then when the water gets up, they look like walking on the water. Here you see the tidal difference. And step by step, oysters will start taking over the legs, so they really become oyster men. Some local fellow. Here the water is already quite high. And here you see some of these anti-landing poles, small oysters. We made the Chinese hat so that it has a little bit of solar panels on it, so that when the night falls down, it illuminates those guys, so that the fishermen know where they are. This is from Taipei, the capital of Taiwan. I got invited by the city government, Department of Urban Development, to make some sketching for ecological restoration. Same time, the city government was destroying this settlement. It's called Treasure Hill. It's an illegal settlement of urban farmers, some sort of urban nomads almost. They go from here and harvest things that the industrial city considers as waste. They take it here and then recycle it, sell back to city. So I went to see this place, and the city was already bulldozing the three first layers of this terraced settlement away. And I found out that actually this illegal settlement contains so many of those things that I was supposed to suggest for the city, that I changed my program. I wanted to make this legal, and I wanted to make this an example for the city. They were, for example, filtering all their grey waters after showers and such, so they have small patches of jungle, and just by gravity the water was coming down, and jungle was cleaning it, and then in the end they use it with the farms. They were composting all their organic waste and used the composted waste as a fertilizer for the farms. They were stealing electricity from the city and stealing water, but just a little, so that it's not annoying too much, but like a parasite, but in a very constructive way. And then they were harvesting waste, all kind of waste, and processing it and selling it back. Here is the Treasure Hill settlement. It was 400 houses. And it's a Kuomintang veterans living there. The guys who pulled back from mainland China in end of 40s. So they're here. Very, very organic, and also living with the flooding river with no problem. The industrial city has big problems. They build flood walls and such, but here, no problem. Just normal. So first thing what the city did when they start to eliminate this settlement was to destroy the farms. First they destroy the farms, and then they destroy the connections between houses. They didn't bother to start fighting with the households, destroying the houses in the beginning. They just made them to suffocate away. So you destroy the connections. Some sort of urban warfare. And so we had to reverse this thing and start to rebuild the farms and rebuild the connections. And when the connections were rebuilt and the farms were rebuilt, the whole settlement became sort of alive again. It's some sort of an axis when you think that there is, if here is zero, and on this side would be destruction. So maybe Treasure Hill was here. And then after this thing, the axis gets little bit tips to the other side of zero, towards construction. And then it can start growing. So it's maybe not a big thing, but makes the total difference. And here was also, because I was, as said, invited by the city government just to do some writing and sketching. I didn't expect to be involved with things like this, so I didn't have any construction materials and didn't have any manpower. So was lecturing in the local universities and recruiting students. In the end, we had 200 students. And there was a bridge construction site just next to this. So we sent a team of, was it five, very beautiful girls into the construction site and explain what we are doing here, and we need material. So then it started happening that the trucks, when they went to the bridge construction site, 8 o'clock in the morning, they stopped here and offloaded maybe 20% and then continued. So all the material got stolen that way, and then we get these volunteers. But also what was very interesting is that when we had a lot of people working here and we had those materials, so it becomes some sort of like hot spot in the city. And people are very sensitive. You know, there is some sort of collective subconscious, how people feel the city and where to move or how to move. And this became kind of a hot spot, or maybe it is some sort of urban acupuncture. And people get curious, and they also start volunteering, because the residents in Treasure Hill, they were really old, maybe 80 years old, veterans. And people start contributing. And suddenly media came in. And when media came in, so after that politicians started to follow. some guy from the cultural department came to recite poems, and then in the end, Mayor Ma in Joe, was jogging in Treasure Hill and with all the TV crews after him. And so this became sexy for politicians. And suddenly they changed the whole program and started to celebrate Treasure Hill, same place that they were destroying 3 weeks before. New York Times flew in. They were writing a story about this is a must-see destination in Taipei. And the whole thing changed. And it got legalized. I had an interesting talk with the city government because they say that actually they cannot make this legal because the houses are built by the guys themselves, so they don't meet any like building codes. Then I was saying that if they've been there for 50 years with all the earthquakes and stuff, so doesn't it prove it? And yeah, but it's against their industrial coding system that they cannot make it legal. And then this commissioner Liao, he came up with a brilliant idea that how about, since you are an artist, so can this become your artwork? And then it was done so that the whole Treasure Hill is now an environmental artwork. The city government made a letter for me, inviting me to make environmental artwork, public environmental artwork for Taipei City, which is now Treasure Hill. It was legalized as an artwork. Then when I was seeing this, the whole Treasure Hill process, I was thinking that if the surrounding city is some sort of like a second generation city, the industrial city, so what is the third generation city? It seemed to be that Treasure Hill was giving a lot of answers. Treasure Hill is also a ruin. In the industrial city you control and forbid everything. Here is just like whatever grows, grows. Nature, including human nature. This is the matriarch of Treasure Hill, Mrs. Chen, just 86 years old. And then we start to interview her, like how she remembers the development of Taipei. And it is very striking to find out that it's still in the living memory, how when the river was so clean that they could drink from it, they washed the kids in it, everybody had water buffaloes and boats and so on. And just this very short industrial time has polluted it all. Ruin is when man-made has become part of nature. This applies, of course, to architectonic scale, but can also apply to urban scale. I think the third generation city is some sort of organic ruin of the industrial city. The industrial system is still continuing, but it is becoming organic. It must become an organic machine. And that will be interesting. Treasure Hill is a little bit that direction. Who cares wins. Then to study a bit more, after this Treasure Hill program, so I got nominated as a professor of ecological urban planning in Tamkang University in Taipei. And then I was teaching there for quite a while and researching. And then while the research grew up, so needed to combine more and more discipline, sociologists and other humanistic sciences, but also engineers for river restoration and such. And I found out, both in Taipei and Finland and other places too, that it's very hard for university to cooperate between different disciplines. That the different disciplines have become so hard and so strong that actually it's turning against the whole idea of university, of sharing knowledge. And some sort of new kind of knowledge-building platform needed to be built up. And in Taipei, we tested this with a place called Ruin Academy. We occupy one five-story high building and change it into a very open platform where different student and research groups could meet with real-life tasks. The tasks were quite often given by the Taipei City government, or we invented them ourselves and then sold them to the government. First thing what we did here was to ruin the building. we knocked down all the interior walls and all the windows, so only the primary structure was left. And then we start drilling holes through the whole building, starting from the roof so that it can rain inside. And when it rains inside, we can direct the water to some corners and make vegetable farms for students or grow bamboo, whatever. But there is some dry corners too where you can squat or sleep. And this is being used now so that some local universities and some universities from Finland and even China is coming there. And they use this kind of like academic squatting. Cannot give any papers to anybody or anything. They're just working there. Different things. There's Emily Chang is playing cello, and then there's a pile of dirt with taro. Taro. Some movable bed. If it rains, so you can move it to some corner and sleep there. And for the windows, we use bamboo. So it's keeping the like typhoon waters a little bit outside. And noise. Student dormitory and working area. Student's vegetable garden. Student. Students with beer. We did this with model. And then just the real work. One-to-one. You can also build up fires. The holes will take care of it. And we, on the top floor, we have a public sauna. Best sauna in the Pacific. Here are some trees. This is a big community gardens and urban farms around Taipei. It's a lot of them. And these farms are actually going through the industrial layers and tuning the whole city towards the organic. This is completely unofficial. Here is one good example. The pink building is Taipei World Trade Center, and this is the most expensive land in Taipei. Three banks have been fighting for it for 20 years. None of the banks have got control, so the anarchist grannies have attacked. And they take over the place. They change it into a garden. It's kind of anarchist gardening. And they change it into a garden. And it's been here for 20 years. So it already become a culture. The kids after school, they go to the grannies. They help with the gardening. They do homeworks there. There is shelters for them and so on. And these kind of places are everywhere in Taipei. It's totally unofficial, but really keeps the city alive. The official city is polluting. This is not polluting. Some topics that we were looking at, illegal architecture. People are building a lot on their own. They just regard the official city as some sort of platform, not the ready product. Urban acupuncture or bio-urban acupuncture. River urbanism. Taipei has a big issue how to reconnect the industrial city with the river and this urban nomad, what it could mean. But it's all based on local knowledge, so we didn't have to invent anything. We're just interviewing these anarchist grannies and fishermen and so on. The real knowledge is there. We don't have to invent it. Little bit about this insect architecture. This is from Shenzhen. Went there and was looking at this phenomena of migrating workers. Hundreds of millions of people are moving to the Chinese cities right now. They are building those places like Shenzhen, skyscrapers. I was hanging around in this compound of illegal workers and asking where they come from. They come, of course, from countryside. And they are very strong what comes to local knowledge from different areas in China. They could really build the third generation city if you use that local knowledge, but that's not recognized in a way. So I asked some of the guys to build them a unofficial community center. There was some abandoned land And these guys came from Guangxi, so they were really masters with bamboo. And I could just draw one-to-one scale to the dirt, how it might be, and then they start building. This is the skyscrapers in the background, what they officially do, and this is their local knowledge in the foreground. It's just one example of the local knowledge. The whole building is done without any nails, basically without any tools. And they find the bamboo around there. And it could just improvise, reorganize nature, and this kind of things come. They needed a stage for karaoke. And the building is giving very nice shade, and it's also dense enough, so the surrounding city is disappearing. You feel that you are in some sort of cocoon. Nighttime, they have one construction light and illuminate the whole thing. Beautiful. Also, same thing like Treasure Hill, when this thing starts to come up, so then the official layers of Shenzhen, including the Hong Kong Shenzhen Biennale, start to recognize this structure and start to get closer and closer and hang around in here. But this is not designed for them and it's not built for them. It's done by these Guangxi guys. Quite amazing. And when you see them work, it was like insects. Just maybe industrial insects. You have some sticks and repeating the same move and weaving this architecture. And you can see that you can make this very big. You can continue. Here is the Biennale stuff getting in. Illegal worker bosses. And things are cooking in the evening. And this is the most wonderful. Like all the time when they were building this, they knew this is going to happen. Like nobody explained to me. I was asking like while they are piling dirt to this wall. And I thought that it's for keeping the bamboo arches. Partly that, yes, but this is the main thing. So the vegetation just took over the whole building. They knew this going to happen. So they were as lazy as possible, but really big effect. And the temperature difference, like today, when it's all green, is huge. Then in Belgium, I wanted to sort of copy that system. I was so impressed about this Guangxi guy, so got invited to Venduin and wanted to deal somehow with the local knowledge there. It's beaches, these dunes are moving all the time, and the local knowledge is actually using willow to direct how the dunes are moving. This using of willow, especially with the Dutch, is very strong. Actually, originally, all the canals are upside down willow buckets. That's keeping the mud in a place. Some say it can stay there 400 years. Very, very strong culture. So then, after talking about this, what could be done with willow and what time of a year and so on, we could somehow imitate that structure of Shenzhen in here with local materials. This is called sandworm. The Shenzhen thing was called bug dome. But this sandworm is 50 meters long and it's 12 meters high and 12 meters wide, situated in the dunes. People are using the beach as some sort of living room, all kind of activities. So also here we decided not to put inside any program. It's just space and they use it how they want. In here we work, like all these works that you see, it's done by ourselves. It's the easiest way. And then we can improvise during the construction process. Of course, we have some idea where we are going, but I'm not so clever. I have found out that when I do drawings that I would understand everything. I don't. It's only if I'm like present in the construction site and when the things start to get like a one-to-one scale and space gets activated, then comes the questions of very fine layers, which I cannot predict. I'm not a fortune teller. So I need to be there, need to be present. Also this one, like no nails was used, nothing, just a willow. And then digging it a little bit, 2 meters into the ground. It's the interior. Kids are the experts of using these kind of structures. But also here, like really weird things started to happen. People start to call this Willow Cathedral. And when this Willow Cathedral started to go on, so then people wanted to get married in here. So they were arranging marriages there. And probably the weirdest thing is that they have witches. And these witches have full moon ceremonies in the sandworm. There is a time when the full moon is in this round hole, and that should be very juicy for the witches. Yeah. But also I would like to stress how important this construction site is for me, like all the construction sites. Like the processes are very long. They can take even some years to finally get to the point that you start constructing, that your friends are flying in and you are like in the action. And that's the reward. Like when that happens, that's the best time, even better than when it's ready, just to construct. Here is our team. Team is changing all the time. We are not a fixed office or anything, more like a circus. Really? Okay, thank you. Aha. Yeah. I think it's in both ways. I try to consider the works in a very many levels or layers, like as environmental art, as architecture, as interior spaces, and even some sort of kind of like theatrical settings. But I need this people impact, or I need to see how people are reacting, and then I can react to it too. I call this kind of a design process open form. I want to first give some design inputs and then get reactions from people. And then I react again, kind of a game. And but it's also kind of a dialogue or maybe even communication. But like the lady was asking, if I sort of fine-tune these works after I see the people's reaction, so that is so. Not predict, but I try to provoke. Yeah, I'm looking for trouble in a way.
Thanks. That was an incredible talk. Privilege to find out about your work. And just thinking through, I don't know if it was chronological, but it felt there was a shift between this creating of temporary structures for biennales and bigger, richer Western, perhaps, developed partners, and then the shift in your work and the sort of shift in the practice with what happened with your work in Taipei. And I wanted to ask you, there it seemed, because perhaps planning laws are more lax, things move faster, so your interventions were able to have a really dynamic impact And then you could feel the shift in the political process mm-hmm. that moved fairly fast. So it really becomes a very dynamic relationship between what you've put in and the effect it's having, and that might then make long-term shifts. One of the big issues, obviously, for anyone who works in a UK context, is that we're unbelievably regulated. Life here is so overregulated. Planning conditions. I made a temporary work on an island in off the coast of Scotland, and it was a work that lasted for 41 days, and I had 68 planning conditions, which I had to purify. So, you know, you have to go through such a turgid, life-denying process mm-hmm. to deliver creative mm-hmm. Output, and this will be the same with the staves. You know, it will be a very controlled. And I just want you to talk a little bit, because you've worked in both places where there is more control and less control, and just how that has affected your practice. Mm.
Well, maybe I've been quite lucky with these commissions or the works, that quite often there have been either it is a Biennale organization or some other organization who takes care of all that legal stuff. They are the ones who need to worry. And quite often it is so that they are sort of taking that challenge already before they ask me to come. So they know that maybe I'm improvising quite a bit and so on, and they try to create me kind of vacuum where I can operate. That is very fortunate. The other way of doing is something what we call Trojan horse, that you promise the city government something, but you smuggle inside of it something very different.
Any other questions? Okay. The one question is the more important question. You already mentioned that some of your projects take a very long time to develop. Mm. So how important is the whole kind of process in terms of development, and how do you sustain a project over a very long time?
These projects have different energy spans. This sustaining of a project is like sustaining the energy, of course. But it's also some kind of a question of a belief, that if some idea or some project becomes like so strong that it sort of toxicates your mind, and that there's no other way of getting rid of it than build it. So that's sustainable.
Last question?
Please, Alice. Hello, I'm Alice Schaffen from Physical Dust. I was very interested that both your presentation and, in fact, Wolfgang's talked about the people that actually build the buildings and actually kind of involve the builders. And I just wondered if you could say something more about that, because it was quite interesting kind of parallels with both people that were building it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also really enjoy construction workers. Like quite often we are living in this kind of conditions that maybe 2/3 of the group is students or some like our guys, and then maybe 1/3 can be construction workers local. And this combination is always quite funny.
Okay.